This is Audible.
Audible Originals presents The Gentleman from Peru. Written by Andre Aciman. Performed by Eduardo Ballerini.
Chapter 1. "Perhaps this might help," said the stranger. He walked over to their table and touched Mark on the shoulder. "Just breathe deeply and count to five." They'd been seeing him for at least 3 days, sitting across from them at a corner table in the hotel's dining area by the pool. Always keeping to himself, occasionally exchanging a few short pleasantries with the tall white-haired waiter, otherwise very quiet and reserved. Though he always sat alone, he never brought anything to read with him, just a green moleskin notebook, which he kept open upside down, like a diminutive camping tent, a tiny black clipless fountain pen, and a pair of glasses, which he tossed on the table with total disregard for how they landed on the tablecloth, as though still denying that he needed them. He was in his early 60s, looked dapper, slim, and always buoyant in his well-pressed double-breasted navy seersucker jacket, a linen shirt, and silver-gray tie topped by a vibrant-colored pocket square. They had spotted him a few times in the lobby or on the long terrace and had begun wondering about him, probably thinking he was another one of those stereotypical semi-retired Italian gentlemen who'd done well for themselves and who picked a spa in the hills for a beach resort where they vacation, socialize a bit, play bridge at night, and for a few weeks managed to stay away from their wives, their mistresses, and grandchildren. But this gentleman didn't socialize, didn't play bridge, hadn't come for the waters or the mud baths, and unlike the other hotel guests, kept asking the waiters to lower the volume of the already muted Vivaldi music piping into the dining area. Once, on heading to what was usually his table, he had thrown a glance in their direction, even given them an imperceptible bow as a passing salutation. But he never uttered a word. They did not return his greeting, feeling that his old-world manner was too chilly and formal for them to know exactly how to respond. Their eyes simply had cast a blank, bewildered stare on his figure, ignoring his distant salutation and trying not to encourage what he might be up to next. "I'm telling you, he's been studying us," said one of them. "Weird," agreed another. Their table was the busiest and largest in the hotel dining area and occupied the space lining a good portion of the balustrade overlooking the beach and the marina on the left. As soon as they'd showed up the first few times, the waiters had hastily joined together three tables and thrown a long tablecloth over them. Later, after they'd all finished eating and left, the waiters would remove the long tablecloth, crumple it up, and separate the tables again. Eventually, seeing that the cohort never went elsewhere for breakfast or dinner, the waiters decided to leave the tables joined together for the remainder of their stay. They were not the only Americans in the hotel, but the youngest and the loudest. When the two guitarists came round to their table in the evening, the women in their group would suddenly beam, turn to face the players, and laugh aloud as they attempted to hum along with the music. Everyone else in the hotel spoke softly, ate very slowly, and drank far less. The young Americans were the last to leave at night, and by the time they'd ordered dessert, all the other tables were already being set up for breakfast. After dinner, most of the aging hotel guests liked to spend their time either in the common area, not far from the lobby, or played bridge in the card room. For them, this was not a resort where you came for a few days, but where you spent at least 3 weeks in the hotel and stayed put there, socializing with other guests who'd been coming here for years, if not decades, and touring the environs a bit only to return for a short swim, then light cocktails and a splendid dinner. The chef, as the hotel staff kept reminding the young signori americani, was world famous and the author of 3 best-selling cookbooks. After dinner, the much older folk would sip mineral water or chamomile on the veranda, or fearing drafts, would eventually repair to the tea room. They were dubbed the knitting pool by the young Americans because 2 of the eldest women were frequently seen knitting, while the men, who later seemed eager to move to the patio to discuss the sorry state of Italian politics, would sit in groups of 3s and 4s before turning in when it got a tad chilly. After dinner, the young Americans liked to crowd into the small bar area that probably housed more gins and single malts than any luxury bar in the United Kingdom. "I wonder if the ladies play gin rummy after napping in the afternoon," said Margot, one of the Americans who worked in an art gallery and was seldom reluctant to crack a snarky remark about people she didn't know. Everyone laughed.
Yes, but do you know what happens to their husbands?
Asked Oscar, who was a Chilean schooled in the United States and had a savage sense of humor. He waited a while for someone to hazard an answer, and seeing no one did, couldn't help but elicit the old joke about why such husbands invariably died first. Why do they die first? Asked Marco, who, to tease him, yanked off his sailor's cap and dropped it on her head.
Because they want to die, he answered.
The group burst out laughing again. Margo stared at the two older ladies who had been discussing knitting stitches and smiled a vague, long-distance smile at them. Just promise to shoot me if I end up knitting in a hotel drinking overheated chamomile when I am 80. And with this, she gave Oscar his sailor's cap again, but to tease him, tilted the visor to his left. He readjusted the cap, but she struggled to turn its visor to his right this time. Old people live way too long, she said, letting go of the hat. The two pensioners didn't know they were the butt of so much humor, and catching smiles on the young Americans from across the dining area, exchanged subdued smiles with them. They're waking up, said Marco. Mustn't rouse the old ducks.
You're being mean again, said Mark, who was the voice of reason in the group.
Margot caught herself, was quiet at first, then staring straight back at him said, I know. But then, seeing no one had said anything, added, I was just thinking of my grandmother who was lucky enough to die in her sleep. I want to be spared getting old.
Still, he added, you shouldn't say things like that. I lost my granny a few weeks ago, and I loved her.
Mark always wore one piece of tennis gear or another even when he wasn't playing. Now, because of a recent injury, he was continually seen rubbing his shoulder. The well-dressed gentleman, however, stood out from everyone else in the hotel and seemed perfectly content to be left alone. Paul, who worked in D.C. for a congressman, had run into the man in the Erie Hotel lobby and, without knowing why, had greeted the gentleman with a noncommittal smile that he couldn't retract in time. The gentleman had made a perfunctory nod but hadn't smiled.
He just hates us, said Mark.
And would you blame him?
Retorted Oscar, laughing.
Yes, but imagine getting stuck in an elevator with him, continued Paul.
Could be a hired assassin type, living off the fat of his Swiss bank account, said Marco.
No, an assassin on his last job.
Who is he killing?
Maybe one of us, said Paul.
I see him as a painter, said Angelica,
who always came to the dining area already wearing a bathing suit and a translucent wraparound.
Maybe. He's too old school to be an artist.
Gives me the heebie-jeebies, said Marco.
After breakfast, the gentleman would leave as quietly as he had entered, and then disappear just as quietly.
Probably meeting his mole.
Mossad.
Why Mossad?
Looks Jewish, and far too slick for someone born into wealth. There's something fishy about him.
You're being mean again, Margot.
After dinner, the gentleman liked to sit on the veranda by himself and smoke a cigarette, sometimes two. On their third night, they watched him do something totally unusual. He had gone back inside, changed into his bathing suit, and walked down the stairs leading to the beach where he started swimming all alone in the dark. The Americans never saw him come back up the stairs.
I can just see it in the papers. Ex-assassin takes his own life.
Stop it already.
I wonder what his deal is.
They agreed that none of them understood him. But then they never gave him much thought and inevitably forgot about him. All they seemed to care about was enjoying the hotel and the surrounding beach. By daylight, they liked to go swimming and boating. They spent long hours at breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And in the evening, after a stint at the hotel bar, they liked to go partying at one of the various nightclubs around the hills. At first, no one could tell why he had walked over to their table, or why he was aiming straight for Mark. But before anyone knew what was happening, he had placed his palm on Mark's right shoulder, did not apologize for intruding, did not ask permission, didn't even hesitate to do what was clearly an invasive gesture. Instead, he spoke his few words with the effortless ease and authority of someone who'd done it many times before.
Perhaps this might help, he said.
Stunned by the move, everyone at their table gaped as the gentleman, who was diminutive by comparison to the athlete, said,
No, don't move yet. Just give it a few seconds.
And then immediately started the countdown.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
after which he slowly removed his hand. The pain should be gone now. Mark, who had been writhing in pain since his shoulder injury while playing tennis, was so startled by the appearance of the stranger in the navy jacket that he did not know how to react or what to say. But moments later, "I can't believe it," he said, standing up. Everyone thought he was about to shove the stranger aside or hit him across the face. Instead, he reached for his right shoulder with his left hand and kept groping the area around it as if trying to see whether the pain had indeed vanished or moved elsewhere. "I can't feel any pain. It's just not there," he repeated with total disbelief. He continued to twist himself around to check his neck, his back, the back of his skull, still trying to determine how the pain, which had been crippling him for days, had slipped away in a matter of seconds simply because the white-bearded stranger in the navy blue sports jacket had taken the liberty of placing a hand to his shoulder and counted down the seconds. "But where did the pain go?" he asked, turning to his friends, as though they'd know any more than he did. He was still startled and kept looking around and behind him as though someone had filched his wallet and was about to toss it over to another guest as a practical joke. For a moment, he seemed to be asking the man who'd healed him to put the pain back where it belonged. But the pain wasn't there. "Pain's like a sneaky reptile," said the stranger. "It appears of its own, inhabits your body for as long as it chooses, sometimes forever. And if you're lucky, it sneaks away without saying goodbye." For a moment, it seemed to Mark that he was being used as an unwitting prop in a party trick. Someone pretends to guess the card you picked, but you know it's a trick. He'll slice a woman in two, but you've seen it done many times. He pulls coins from behind your ear, and you laugh like a three-year-old, though you suspect it's a sham. Sometimes someone will hypnotize you and make you say things in public you wouldn't dare whisper to yourself, but all along you know it's bogus. On a rare occasion, a magician will explain his trick to his public, and just when everyone thought they got it and couldn't wait to perform it on someone else, lo and behold, the explanation turns out to be a party trick as well, and you're no wiser than you were at the beginning of the show. But this was real. As the man said, the pain didn't even bother saying goodbye. "So it's like gone, gone?" Mark asked. "Or will I find it at the count of three?" The stranger looked at him with a patronizing smile, the way Jesus might have looked at Lazarus after raising him from the dead, meaning, "Have faith, brother. You're good to go." "And I can throw away all the meds everyone made me buy these past few weeks?" "For all you know, you can flush them down the toilet," he said, almost with an amused snicker in his voice. "You'll be fine, trust me." "And you do this for free?" Mark asked, already worried at being presented with a bill. "Totally for free," echoed the gentleman. "On the house." "No second visit?" Mark finally asked, meaning to inject humor so as not to look totally humbled by the experience. "No second visit." "So this is it, then?" an incredulous Mark continued. "This is it." "Seriously?" The older man looked at Mark with quizzical eyes. "Look, I'm no soapbox huckster, and this was not a magic show," he finally said, in flawless Oxonian English that bore the faintest trace of a Hispanic accent. "It was obvious from my table that you were in pain. I could see you writhing and stiffening, and I wanted to make it go away. That's all. I promise, promise." Sensing the heavy silence that had fallen between them, the stranger seemed about to click his heels, withdraw and go back to his table, when Mark invited him to join them for a glass of wine and dessert. He had meant to add a few words of thanks, but the stranger hushed him with a gesture and simply said, "With pleasure," to the invitation. They squeezed their chairs together to make room for an extra chair, which the tall waiter brought to their table. "It will be my second glass of wine and dessert. I try not to have more than one a day." He asked them what had brought them to this place. The question made almost all of them laugh as they looked around the table as though polling who was going to tell their story. "We're invited," said Basil, a lawyer in a large firm specializing in mergers. "I have a friend who rented the boat we sailed on, but at the last minute he had to stay in New York and wasn't able to come with us to Lisbon, so the boat picked us up in Lisbon, and we've been sailing since, hoping to meet up with him at some point." "But why here?" asked the stranger. "Apparently there's engine trouble, which is why we had to stop.
The mechanic said they're working on repairs, but frankly, being here in this hotel, with this beach and everything paid for, is beyond amazing. I, for one, don't care how long the repairs take.
Agreed, said Emma. Engine trouble or not, I'm seriously tempted to unpack my things, settle here, and live the rest of my life with my paintbrushes, canvases, beautiful views, and be as far away from New York and every male of our species.
Then after a pause, I am Emma, she said.
You look like such fast friends on a splendid private cruise.
He envied their camaraderie, he said. Well, we all graduated from college 10 years ago. We made a vow.
What vow?
That the first to get rich would rent a boat and invite the others on a cruise. None of us made millions, but Malcolm did, and he made good on his promise.
Except he isn't with you because of work.
Except he isn't with us because of work, echoed Angelica, with a wry inflection in her voice, as if reproaching him for being far too devoted to his millions when there were other, better things in life. But tell us who you are, she asked.
My name is Raoul, he answered.
A round of introductions and handshakes followed. Mark, Basil, Emma, Claire, Angelica, Paul, Margot, and Oscar. They were 8 at their table, so Basil was sure that Raoul wouldn't remember their names. But Raoul shook hands with everyone with a show of paying attention to each name. How long had he been staying here? Mark asked.
10 days.
Where was he from?
Originally Peru,
but he had studied in England and France as well as in the United States.
Was this his first time here?
No. He'd been coming here almost every summer since his earliest childhood. He still owned a house on the hill, but never slept there, as it was leased to a family friend.
Where was he off to next?
Back to France, he told them.
But I'm somewhat attached to this place, he explained.
Somewhat attached? Quipped Margot, echoing his words. What does that mean, exactly? Either you are or aren't attached to it.
Raoul turned to her and smiled broadly, almost amused at the gratuitous dig.
I suppose more attached to it than I might care to claim.
He didn't seem to mind being riled, and Margot had a mirthful way about her that could pry open impacted doors. Why more attached than you might care to claim? Asked a perplexed Margot, who echoed his words, but hearing vagueness in them, was pouncing on every opportunity to get him to say what he meant.
Don't pay attention to her manner, interrupted Emma. She can't rein it in once she starts. She's just playing with you.
I like that. It might make me tell more than I normally like to tell a perfect stranger.
I'm not perfect, Margot snapped. Anyone will tell you that.
He looked at her, smiled once more, said nothing at first, then quietly added,
But you are perfect, and you know it too. Though you may be wrong about one thing.
How so?
You're not a stranger.
But noticing she seemed quite baffled by his remark, he decided not to clarify his meaning. But she wasn't letting him off the hook.
So why aren't we strangers? She asked, with a nervous, undecided smile.
She was, as her expression suggested, giving him all the rope needed to hang himself. You've been watching us for days now, so obviously you might know a few things about us.
That's not why we aren't strangers.
Margot's shoulders stiffened.
So let's hear it, she said, staring at him with the same goading smile.
You two are having fun, I can tell, said Oscar. When was the last time we saw Margot smile?
She never smiles, said Mark. I wasn't smiling, she protested.
There was a pause. The gentleman asked for a second glass of wine.
It will be my third, he said, almost as though admitting to a weakness. A terrible precedent.
Then after a pause,
Your name is Maria, he threw in.
My name is Margot.
She was snapping at him now.
Yes, but I could have sworn Maria was your birth name.
Why?
If you ask, it's because you already know the answer.
She looked at him with rising displeasure, but decided to contain her temper.
My mother had wanted to name me Maria, but my father wanted Margaret, so they settled on Margot. But nobody knows this. How could you possibly have known? Did you know her? Did you know my mother?
She sounded irked and angry, as though ready to go to battle.
I know many things about all of you.
Oh? Name some, said Margot.
I will tell you, but on one condition. First, may I have a slice of the cassata? It's very good, which is why I never order it.
Basil signaled to the waiter.
So what is it that you know?
Raoul took a hasty sip from his glass. This is when, turning to Mark and holding the refilled wine glass lightly between two fingers, he uttered one word only.
22.
Mark looked at him quizzically.
What about 22?
He asked.
You know exactly, replied Raoul.
But Mark had no idea what. Then it hit him.
You looked me up at the front desk, he exclaimed.
No, I didn't.
But it is January 22, isn't it? Suddenly, Mark looked around the table and began to feel as hollow and transparent as the near-emptied bottle of wine standing in the glass bucket next to him. But for his shoulder, he would have dismissed the whole thing. He didn't believe in the supernatural, couldn't stand anyone who did, and the air of uplifted piety on those who speak of auras and astral houses brought out the worst in him. Now he was no longer sure. Raoul looked around the table as though groping for an answer. But he wasn't groping for an answer.
I can tell, for example, that you were born in May, he said to Claire.
And the two of you are born in August, he told Angelica and Paul, which says a lot. And you, he said, turning to Basil, are November.
Silence around the table. He told the remaining three sitting at the table the month of their birth. No one disagreed.
You left me out, said Marco.
I know.
Well?
You're born on a leap year, are you not? He said, turning to Marco. Do you like February 29th or March 1st? Your pick?
She looked totally dumbstruck.
Let's drink to that, said Basil, turning to the waiter who had just opened another bottle of red after clearing away the white.
You looked us up online, said Basil. The easiest trick in the book.
No, I didn't, said the gentleman from Peru. So let me turn to you, Basil, he added with a tone that had lost all humor. You had a twin brother, but he died in utero, and by the time you were born, there wasn't a trace of him left.
This is total nonsense, said Basil,
trying to contain himself and remain cordial with the gentleman. Then with a glint of irony on his features,
are you suggesting I cannibalized my twin brother?
Happens more often than you think.
This is totally freaky, said Mark.
If you don't believe me, please text your mother in New Orleans right now and ask if she had expected twins.
How do you know she lives in New Orleans?
Without looking at Basil, Raoul simply stared at his empty glass and said,
I just know.
How could you possibly know about twins? Asked Basil. Did you have access to hospital records? Unless you knew my mother or her gynecologist or whatever.
I don't like rummaging into family secrets. So let's stay with the missing twin, said Raoul.
Meanwhile, Basil had taken out his phone and began texting the question to his mother.
We'll see what she says,
he said, still shaking his head at the absurdity of the question he had just asked his mother.
I already know what she'll say, said Raoul.
Oh, don't listen to him,
said Margot, fidgeting in her seat and looking more vexed by the minute. This whole thing is one big hoax, Basil. He looked us up online. He's probably the hotel magician, hustler, and con artist who comes with breakfast, free Wi-Fi, and cable TV, she said, turning to Mark. Was the shoulder cure a hoax as well?
Well, maybe it's a placebo effect, interjected Mark. But to be honest, the pain did go away.
If you believe I'm a swindler, let me be more specific.
And turning to Emma, he said, you lost someone 2 months ago.
I did.
You'd borrowed but never returned his watch.
Yes?
The reversible watch with the blue face.
That's correct.
And the man was your father.
Totally stunned, Emma sat still. Her chin was quivering, and she was clearly on the verge of tears.
I kept it because I knew he was dying, and I didn't want it left in the house with all the visiting nurses around. In my absurd moments, I kept hoping to return it to him if he got better. But how do you know all this?
I'll explain later. But I couldn't have looked it up, could I?
He said, turning to Margot, who for some reason seemed even more flustered as she leaned forward, looked around the table, and finally stood up, saying,
I think I'll go for a walk.
Raoul raised his head and looked at her.
Don't go yet, please.
She did not reply and simply rammed her chair back to the table. It made a loud noise. But then she stood bolted to her spot.
Meanwhile, here it is,
said Basil, who had just that moment received a text from his mother in New Orleans.
And what does your mother say?
Asked Margot. Basil stared at Raoul.
You were right. Apparently they had suspected twins, but only one child was born. But my mother asked, how did I know this? And honestly, I don't know what to tell her.
Tell her nothing. This is becoming really ugly, exclaimed Margot, and in a huff, scuttled out of the dining area.
I think I must have upset her, said Raoul as he turned, looking totally surprised.
With Margot, one never knows. So I'll enjoy this last drop of wine and head back to my room, said Raoul.
But he was staring at Angelica and Paul.
You are not married, are you?
Paul seemed startled by the question and hesitated before answering.
I'm not. She is.
I thought you knew everything, came his little dig.
Here is what I do know. You were in love in college, weren't you? Yet neither of you ever did anything about it. No one knew. You yourselves didn't know, or didn't want to know, and have been struggling not to know it ever since, even now among your friends at this very table. Am I right so far?
Paul looked over at Angelica, smiled very uneasily, and turning to her said,
He may have a point.
Angelica did not respond right away.
Could be,
she said, but was quiet again, and then speaking softly and smiling awkwardly, trying to make light of what had just been said.
Do you think Raoul's on to us? Just maybe, maybe?
Why, have I spoken out of turn? Asked a baffled Raoul.
Nah, we've known for years, intervened Basil. Everyone here suspected. How long did it take for this to come out?
Just 10 years, said a humbled Paul.
Feels like 50 to us, said Oscar, laughing.
Actually, said Raoul, it took 3 centuries.
Any more stunning revelations in your bag of tricks, old man? Asked Oscar.
Raoul did not say anything. He just stood up.
Enough magic for one round, he said,
and politely pushed back his seat without making a sound. Chapter 2. The next evening, the group of young Americans walked into the dining area just about when everyone else in the hotel was finishing dessert. Raoul, as always, was starting his second course by himself. As soon as the Americans spotted him, they greeted him. Mark even patted him on the back with the jovial, hail fellow, semi-patronizing gesture, meant both to express his abiding gratitude and to erase the pitiable figure he must have cut the day before as the injured athlete of the group. They asked if he would like to join them for drinks at the hotel pub after he was done with dinner.
With pleasure, replied the gentleman from Peru.
They had planned on going to one of the clubs around the hill, but had decided to stay put on the hotel grounds.
You'll be our guest, or rather, Malcolm's guest. We've told him about you. He's sorry he couldn't be here to meet you.
Raoul gave the invitation to the bar table some thought, almost as though he regretted having accepted so readily and should have reconsidered. But he had another reason for being suddenly absorbed in thought.
Tell Malcolm to beware of any last-minute transaction before the market closes today. He may not be able to avert or reverse its course, but he can certainly take provisions by hedging against the risks. Don't forget.
Basil made an it's been duly noted gesture, but Raoul, pointing his fork at him, insisted.
Tell him now, as in this minute.
Now as in now?
Exactly, said Raoul. Call him.
I've no idea what crazy ventures he's involved in, explained Raoul to those standing around him.
But I know that this one is dangerous, and he needs to sell before the market closes today.
The call was made. It lasted no more than a few seconds. Angelica grabbed the phone and told him she missed him. He missed her too.
Malcolm thanks you, she told Raoul a moment later.
Later in the evening, as they gathered in the tiny pub and ordered drinks, Mark remarked that if Raoul was so good at forecasting volatile shifts in the market, why hadn't his skills helped him make a fortune himself?
Because I know nothing about the markets. Besides,
I'm always afraid of risking the funds my good parents left me. I often know what dangers lie in store or what people are planning or plotting to do. But I've been tragically blind in the past. The greatest catastrophe in my life caught me totally by surprise. There have been other terrible instances where my predictions simply proved totally wrong. But birthdays and past events are not difficult for me. Still, I know something is afoot in New York today. You watch. Something will happen just before the market closes in half an hour. As they were relishing their drinks, Raoul told them he'd take them to see something special in the coming days if they had nothing better to do. Had any of them read the Aeneid? Many of them had read bits and pieces. "Courtesy of our liberal arts education, which cost our parents a fortune," said Oscar. "And yet it all boils down to bits and pieces, which is why we know nothing."
"Exactly," said Marco.
"They taught us contemporary poetry and contemporary issues, even contemporary grammar. But ultimately, like Margot says, nothing," said Oscar.
"Like Margot says?" she asked, making fun of him.
"As Margot says, apologizomai."
Everyone laughed, courtesy of College Greek 101. All toasted their alma mater. Raoul didn't quite understand why they were laughing, but let the matter pass. He simply added that, if they wanted, he would take them to where Cuma was, one of the spots where Aeneas stopped on his travels after leaving Carthage. There, incidentally, lies the entrance to Avernus, the doorway to the world of the dead on Lake Avernus.
"Have you been there?"
asked Margo.
"Yes, but never alone."
"Why? I'd like to go," said Paul.
"Me too," said Angelica.
It's the kind of thing Fellini would have loved. A group of friends working their way down a craggy passage into the underworld where we're told Styx, the sacred river, ran. There you'll see the morning fields, the Lugentis Campi, where all broken hearts tell their woebegone tales of love to anyone who passes by and cares to stop to listen. Phaedra, who took her own life for loving her stepson after she opened up her heart to him. Dido, who lit a fire and threw herself into it while Aeneas watched her burn from aboard his ship to Italy. Procris, who was mistakenly speared by her lover. And poor Cenis, raped by a god and begging to be turned into a man so as never to be raped again. Haven't you all been burned and speared and raped in your hearts at least once?"
"No comment," said Oscar, which made everyone burst out laughing. But no one answered.
"Which means all of you have," said Raoul.
"Everyone's been hurt. But I still can't believe that people actually take their own lives for love. It's so kitsch, so camp."
That was Marco.
"I almost did once. At least, I thought of it very, very seriously," said Emma. "But I wasn't going to do it with violence or with pills, so I decided to starve myself. And I almost did. Then one day I saw someone eating country bread with triple cream cheese and drinking a glass of red, and I said, 'Enough!'"
"It would be just like Emma to be saved by cheese," said Oscar.
"Not for me either, the Lugentis fields," interrupted Claire, the quiet one who was a teacher. "Even though I've spent 2 years on those fields obsessed over a woman who'll never know how much I ached for her."
"Marisol? Are we back to Marisol? Why am I not surprised? Claire, get over it, please. You've been bellyaching for years."
That was Margot again. But Claire didn't seem to hear Margot.
"We always know when someone loves us, even when we don't want their love. Marisol knows," said Claire. "I know she knows."
"And what about you, Raoul? Have you crossed the Lugentis Campi?" Claire asked Raoul. Raoul did not answer right away. But then,
"Yes, I have. We never recover. Whoever bruised us left a mark that stays there forever. Do we ever recover from our parents, or from the cruelty of our first arithmetic teacher, or from someone loved in adolescence? You may seek to recover, and many of us are persuaded we have, until we realize that if we commit the same mistakes time and time again, it's not because we keep choosing the wrong partner, or because we don't know how to love, but because new loves won't help us heal from that one ancient wound. All new love can do is mask the wound, and for some, this is good enough."
"Did someone hurt you that much?" asked Marco.
"Yes, once. But only once."
"And?"
I never discuss it.
Which tells us you've never recovered, said Marco, clearly pleased to score a point at the expense of the gentleman from Peru.
It was fate that hurt me, not her. But back to Avernus, he said, clearly trying to change the subject. If you visit the site of the entrance to the underworld, you'll see where dead souls shamble about, complaining of this and that, some with remorse in their hearts, others with regrets, each waiting to be called up to have a say on who they'll want to be once they're brought back to life, not realizing why most keep making the wrong choice each time they're alive again. We come back to correct our lives, because most lives are lived imperfectly.
Why do they keep making the wrong choice?
Why? Because no one wants to accept who they truly are. Everyone requests the self they believe is the very best, hoping to be loved for who they're not and could never be. And the tiny miracle of life, the tiniest yet most imponderable miracle, is when we stumble on people who see us for who we are and want us just for who we are. And these are the ones we spurn the most, the ones we let into our lives with resentment, scorn, and boundless apathy, sometimes even with hatred. But the moment two individuals love each other for who each truly is, then time for them stops. And if these two don't die together, then the partner who lives on never recovers, never forgets, and keeps waiting until they meet again in who knows how many lifetimes. In Shakespeare's own words, either is the other's mine. The beloved always comes back, always will. But the wait is excruciating. They wait not just to live together, but also to die together. You see, it's life that is provisional, not love.
The group sat stupefied by Raoul's words.
What I'd love to do is invite all of you tomorrow morning to the bubbling sulfur craters of Botswali, near which we're told Aeneas went into the underworld, and where Ulysses spoke to dead Achilles, and then without warning, suddenly ran into his mother and said, "Did you die then too, mother?" And thereupon tries to embrace her three times, and three times clutches just air. Haven't we all embraced air when all we wanted was to hold someone dear to us when they were gone from our lives? We too become air, you know. And just think of all the people we'll never know exist, but who embrace us each and every night in their fantasy lives. We're heir to them no less than we are heir to those we love in secret.
You make the underworld sound so very real. Is there really such a place? Asked Paul.
It's in Homer.
And he never ever lies, said Marco.
You're pulling my leg, I can tell.
She smiled. Meanwhile, the waiter came to deliver another round of drinks, and a sudden whiff of something rose from their martinis and filled the tiny room.
"What's that incredible smell?" Basil asked.
"It's just the lemons that grow on the Amalfi Coast," said Raoul. "Nothing like them in the world. You don't know what lemon really is until you taste these."
"Here," said Raoul, calling the waiter back and asking him to bring a fresh lemon with a paring knife. The waiter did as he was asked, and returned with a shiny lemon plus a small sharp knife. Raoul held the lemon in his left hand and began to carve out pieces of the rind, which he distributed to Paul and Angelica, then to Basil, and then to every one of those present, including three tourists who happened to overhear Raoul's effusive elegy on lemons.
"Have you ever smelled lemons like this?" he asked.
"No, never," came the choral response.
Margot was the last to be given a piece of the rind, and was almost unwilling to take it from Raoul's hand.
"It won't kill you," he said, realizing she was reluctant to have anything to do with lemons, or with him.
Yet he did not seem to mind her ill-concealed hostility. She took one sniff, then dropped the rind into the nearest ashtray. Everyone kept smelling their little sliver of rind without letting go. Mark kept holding his and would periodically take a whiff of it.
"Now you know why I need to return to Italy every year," said Raoul.
"To smell the rind of a lemon?" Typical Margot sarcasm.
You may be right, said Raoul. Sometimes the best things couldn't be simpler. The scent of lemon, a few bars from a Beethoven quartet, the shining broad shoulder of a woman in a bathing suit resting on beach towel, a seascape by Dufy, or just the smile on someone's face you love. Can we add Kalila from Scotland to the list? And olives from Greece? Or mangoes from India? Foie gras from France? And five golden rings, rang Oscar's voice. Everyone burst out laughing. Then from nowhere, one of them asked, when did you learn how to heal people? Raoul smiled, as though already sensing that the question, seemingly harmless, was only the opening volley to a series of more questions. I don't know exactly, but when I look back, I probably learned by getting hurt myself and applying a hand to my hurt knee. Everyone instinctively touches that part of our body when we've banged it against something. So I touched my knee. 5 seconds after I'd touched it, the pain went away. I thought everyone did so. When I played with children my age, whenever someone hurt himself in the park or the sandbox, they'd immediately place a hand where they hurt. One day I saw a child touch his hurt knee, but his pain wasn't going away, and he was crying. So I literally gave him a hand, and right away his pain was gone. He told his mother. I expected the mother to rush to thank me profusely. Instead, she warned me never to touch her son again. Niente stregonerie, capisci? She said, meaning I was a witch. I was convinced I'd done something terribly wrong. From then on, each time someone was hurt, I'd leave them alone and would watch them suffer. When my mother had a kidney stone and woke up one night in terrible agony, I asked her if she could point the spot where the pain was. She indicated her waist and the back of her kidney. She couldn't even locate the source of pain around her midriff. I asked her to place my hand on the spot itself, but I didn't want her to know why I was asking, for fear she too would think me a witch. She took hold of my hand and placed it around where the pain radiated. And right away, within the count of a few seconds, the pain was gone. As did her kidney stone, which was tiny and which she passed a few hours later. I denied I had anything to do with it, but from that day on I knew. My mother never spoke about it, but I'm sure she knew. A few years later, when she had an infection on her foot, she asked if I could do something. And of course I did, with the same result. How old were you at the time? 7. But I knew I had that gift since 2, even younger. Do you even remember things as far back as that? No one remembers being 3. Raoul looked down silently at his martini with the lemon rind floating inside it, and then stared at the rindless little lemon sitting bared and scarred next to the large peanut bowl. Everyone sitting in the bar area could sense that something serious had crossed his mind, but that he was reluctant to discuss it. I go back, he finally said, looking up and holding his glass as if for sympathy and support, knowing that everyone's eyes were now riveted on him. You go back? Said Emma, and after a pause, what does that mean, you go back? Once again, Raoul looked down at his glass ruefully and was clearly trying to avoid giving explanations. Breaking a small piece from a breadstick that had come with the drinks, he put it into his mouth as if it were a cigarette. This is making me nervous, said Claire. Okay, one last question, and then I promise I'll stop, said Emma. Go ahead, he said, again with that guileful smile of someone who'd heard all of it so many, many times before. He picked up his paper napkin, wiped some of the condensation around the glass, and looking satisfied with how his glass looked now, took a sip. What did you mean by going back? She asked. Again, he looked around the table. I don't want to upset anyone, or make anyone uncomfortable, nor do I want to sound unnecessarily cryptic. But I'll answer this one question, and then please, can we move on to another subject? Okay. The point is, we all go back. We spend more time than we know trying to go back. We call it fantasizing. We call it dreaming. We give it all manner of names. But we're all crawling back, each in his or her own way. Very few of us know the way,
Most never find the door, much less the key to the door. We're just groping in the dark. Some of us may even feel we're not from planet Earth, but have come down from elsewhere, and are all pretending to be normal Earthlings. And yet, not one of us is. We might as well come from Mars, or as happens to be my case, from a very distant place, or planet, called Peru, which may no longer even exist for me. Some know their way back, and some won't ever know.
And which kind are you then? Asked Marco, who had obviously been listening and was no longer heeding the young man who had accosted her and had joined the clan in the bar.
Sometimes I know the way. Then, seeing no one was reacting. And sometimes I can lead the way.
Wait, said Emma. What does lead the way mean?
Suddenly Raoul looked serious. It means that I can take you back to places you knew long, long before.
Before what? Asked Emma, clearly growing very impatient. Before you were born. Even I could figure that one out, blurted Marco.
But Raoul had read the situation correctly. After hearing such talk, no one in the room could resist thinking of the questions they wished to ask, which explains the sudden silence as each hovered above him like an undecided bird circling the air before finally landing on its branch.
Let me put it this way. All of us remember having had another self, which could be a mirage or a fleeting sense of someone we've been long ago, perhaps elsewhere. Call it a hinter self who feels less transient than we'd like to believe.
But here's the catch, he said, stopping midway, as if to collect his thoughts and take another sip.
And the catch is?
Margot asked, unable to stand the silence, and almost determined to be testy, perhaps to prove once and for all that the gentleman from Peru was fabricating the whole thing.
This other self of ours may not be a bygone self, but a self living elsewhere, even as we're having drinks this very minute in this fabulous hotel.
You mean as in a parallel universe?
Call it what you will. But there may be more selves out there. Some still unsprung, like tiny egg cells that haven't been fertilized. Some already released, and some waiting for the end. Each one of us is a constellation of selves. Some are not even lodged in us, but in other people, which is why sometimes we recognize others right away. Because they are us in someone else's body.
This time Raoul grabbed a few peanuts from the bowl and began to chew them ever so slowly.
How many at this table have at least once called an old phone number that you knew was no longer yours?
None of those present said they had, but all gave a startled giggle at the question.
You didn't come out to say you tried, but you all laughed, which proves my point. You've all called an old phone number. And what do you tell the person who picks up the phone if someone does pick up? Hello, I am an older you. Greetings and salutations. Or it could be the other way around. I am the you haven't quite become yet. Or let me ask a different question then. How many have passed by an old apartment where you used to live once and then looked upstairs to see if the person you were back then still has his lights on?
Startled giggles again.
Exactly. And how many have sought out an old love to test if the old lover we once were was still alive in us, only to be totally surprised when we caught ourselves almost willing to start all over again with someone whose last name we couldn't for the life of us recall?
No answer. We may no longer be the person we once were. But what if this person did not necessarily die, but continued his life in the shadowland of our own, so that you could say that our life is filled with shadow selves who continue to tug along and to beckon us in all directions even as we live our own lives, all these selves clamoring to have their say, their time, their life, if only we listened and gave in to them. What if we switch roles from time to time and become the shadow self of the person we were 2 minutes ago, and then sideline that new self moments later for a third or a fourth?
What if we are no more than a perpetual three-card monte of reshuffled hinter selves? We traffic in shadow selves. The old self, the new self, the shadow self, self number 7 or number 11, the self we always knew we were but never became, the self we left behind and never recovered, the might-have-been self that couldn't be but might still be, though we both fear, yet hope, might come along one day and rescue us from the person we've had to be all our years. But as I said, it's not just the past that haunts us. What haunts us with equal magnitude is what has not happened yet. For there are shadow selves and shadow lives waiting in the wings all the time. We are constantly reworking and reinventing both the past and the future. Sometimes we're in the street or in a crowded bus, and we just know that one day this person whose glance we caught or whose path we just crossed is another version of someone we know we've loved before and have yet to love again. But that person could just as easily be us in another body. And the beauty of it is that they feel it just as much as we do. Is this other person us? Or is it someone destined for us whom we keep missing each lifetime? Us in others. Isn't this the definition of love? Oscar was about to ask a question, but then changed his mind and remained silent. So let me close with this thought, since I have your attention but may have bored all of you to death already. The important thing is not knowing that there is or that there was or that there might be another us somewhere. What matters, my friends, is making contact. Only connect. The most difficult thing on earth. Do you think it is an accident that your boat needed to stop here, or that Mark's shoulder hurt, or that we are all here having a truly lovely and unusual evening? Maybe, or maybe not. And on that note, let us toast with another round of martinis, on me this time. Then, suddenly remembering, call Malcolm! Wouldn't you already know what he did? Came Margot's snide remark. I do know, but I want everyone else here to hear it from him. Basil right away picked up his phone and dialed New York. When Malcolm picked up, Basil put the phone on speaker mode. I don't know what made me take the advice of some loser type you guys just met at the beach, but just tell him that if I'd given him 10% of what I managed to rescue thanks to him, he'd be a millionaire. Raoul snickered at the word loser type. Tell him he owes me nothing, and that I was only happy to help. But if he wishes, he could make a generous donation to